This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Being a teacher means mastering quite a few things: communication, innovation, empathy, and you may not have thought of this one, ethics. In fact, educators come across ethical dilemmas almost every day, and how they deal with them affects students in profound ways, not to mention themselves.
Teachers and school leaders and policymakers, school board members, actually parents and students themselves, are often wrestling with ethical questions, but we aren't having the same kind of open public conversation about that.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the co-author of a new book on educational ethics. We'll also spend an academic minute seeing if lapses in ethics can be blamed on your hormones. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Educators and policymakers confront challenging questions of ethics on a regular basis. Should teachers retain a struggling student if it means she will almost certainly drop out? Should an assignment plan favor middle-class families if it means strengthening the school system for all? These everyday dilemmas are both utterly ordinary and challenging. Yet there are very few opportunities and resources out there to help educators think through the ethical issues at stake. Now, drawing on research and methods developed in the Justice in Schools project of the Harvard Graduate School of Education, the new book, Dilemmas of Educational Ethics, Cases and Commentaries, introduces a new approach to solving many of these ethical puzzles. Miera Levinson is one of the co-authors of the book. Dr. Levinson is a professor of education at Harvard University. We spoke about the book and I asked, why study ethics in education?
In large part because I think that teachers and school leaders and policymakers, school board members, actually parents and students themselves, are often wrestling with ethical questions, but we aren't having the same kind of open public conversation about that as we are about other aspects of teaching and learning and education policy. So we talk really openly about questions of assessment, evaluation, teacher quality, school leadership, the instructional core, things like that. But in fact, a large part of what educators and policymakers are thinking about are these ethical questions, but because we're not really talking about it, we're not giving people any resources to think through that and make better ethical decisions.
I mean, you talk about six big topics in this book, and one of the topics, promotion or retention of a student, I never really thought of that as the, you know, in the terms of ethics, but I guess now that you hear it, you can't unthink it.
Right. Good. That's our point. Right. I mean, I think certainly teachers think about this as an ethical question, right? You know, what are my obligations to this kid? What are my obligations to other kids? So just to give a little sense of what the case is about, this is a case of an eighth grader, Adawadis, who has not met the criteria to be promoted to ninth grade. She's reading at a fifth grade level. She's failing a couple classes. She missed a bunch of school, right? And if you look at what the promotion requirements are, she needs to be retained in eighth grade. On the other hand, she's 15 years old. She was already retained in second grade once. She's going to turn 16 next October. The teachers know that she's very, very likely to drop out. She's failing her classes in part because she's been bouncing around foster homes, which is why she's been absent from school. And that actually followed up on her watching her brother get shot and killed on the porch next to her. And one of the reasons she's failing science is because while she was bouncing around the foster homes and out of school, her science teacher went out on maternity leave and the school brought in a long-term sub who's a French and theater studies major. And as Adawadis said to him, you know, you ain't going to turn into Mr. Science. And so, and although she's reading at a fifth grade level, she came into eighth grade reading at a third grade level, and she stayed after school virtually every day in order to improve her reading skills. So they really are caught on the horns of the ethical dilemma. What do they owe to Adawadis? What about the other kids who are going to be in class with her next year? How can they help the system function the best? What does it mean to take account of her academic gaps, her social and emotional needs? Who are they kind of to play God, right, with the life of this kid? Is that even the right way to talk about it? One of the commentators talks about her human rights and thinking about it from a human rights perspective. We have various commentators about each case. Another commentator who's a district leader talks about the way the system is supposed to work and that if the teachers do see themselves as playing God with Adawadis, then in fact they're undermining the system as a whole. These are incredibly tough ethical questions, but often we're kind of swimming around in this morass without really having good guidance or tools to talk through these tough questions with each other.
And there's always the aspect hanging in the background of money when it comes to retention. You've got a lot of school districts now, and even universities and colleges. If students don't keep going, they lose funding.
That's true. Although, you know, she'll stay in the district if she goes on to ninth grade. You know, she's at high risk of dropping out in some ways, no matter what happens. But yes, money is a huge consideration that actually comes up some. We don't talk about it as directly as we might. In a different case we have on charter schools, comparing charters and the local district as a way of trying to figure out, is it possible to compare schools? Like, how do we think about the quality of charters versus district schools? Whom should they serve? Are they obligated to serve the same kids, and why or why not? And one of the reasons that those questions matter, in addition to sort of the ethical questions of what kids should be served by whom under what circumstances, is that money is a huge issue in thinking about, say, money going to charters versus money going to regular district public schools.
Going back to the question of promotion and retention, and the thought of putting a fifth grade reader into a ninth grade class goes into one of the other issues you spoke about, which was group needs versus the individual needs.
Yeah, exactly. I had somebody ask me, well, why wouldn't we always privilege the group over the individual? And my response was that, you know, in a democracy, right, we have made the choice, I think rightly, to say that there's a whole variety of individual rights where we specifically are not making this sort of utilitarian calculus of where we're calculating, well, what will be the greatest good for the greatest number? But we say, no, individuals, say, have rights to free speech. They have rights to freedom of assembly. They have rights to freedom of movement. You know, we have all sorts of rights, even when that makes things, say, harder or worse for the group as a whole. And I think there's a huge ethical question, right, about what do we owe Adewadis, and how can we ensure that she, as a child, gets what she deserves from society and the opportunity to lead a fulfilling, healthy, productive, self-supporting life. But then also, how do we attend to all the other children who also have similar rights and to whom we owe similar responsibilities when those potentially are in conflict with one another?
Is there a good answer to that? Solve the problems of the world right now.
Yeah, my answer is no. There's no one right answer, and there's no way just to solve the problem fully. But there are worse answers and there are better answers. So a worse answer is to just write kids like Adewadis off completely. I think that that is an unethical response for some of the reasons that I was just talking about what we owe, in fact, to every individual child. And that was an answer that we gave as a country, in fact, for a couple of centuries, right? If kids did not fit into school, if they had any kinds of special needs, including, say, physical disabilities, right? No mental disabilities, but just sheer physical disabilities. Until fairly recently, actually, we didn't allow them to come to school, or we kicked them out once they came. And I think rightly, we have made a different set of commitments now to kids, saying, no, every child deserves the opportunity to get a high-quality education and deserves to get the resources and the services in order to lead a productive, fulfilling life. But so that's a better answer, but how you realize that answer in concrete practice in a specific situation, which is what we have educators and school leaders and district leaders and policymakers sort of trying to figure out every day, I don't think that there's one clear right answer or even necessarily a best answer. And that's part of what this book is trying to do, is help people, help start a conversation so that they can come up with better answers in concrete contexts to solve the problems that they're facing.
You have so many interesting stories and so many interesting people in this book. Where did you find these people?
Well, so I was a teacher for 8 years in the Atlanta and the Boston public schools. Adewadis' case is actually a composite of a number of cases that I faced with my own eighth grade teaching team over the years. Others of them, like the charter school case, and we have a case about school assignment in the Boston Public Schools and how they assign seats through the lottery, came because these are live, you know, political issues in education reform and education practice right now. And so I read newspaper articles and I talked to people and I scoured public data. And others, we have a case about a kid who steals a cell phone from his teacher in a zero tolerance district and the teacher is trying to figure out what to do. The co-author on that case, Kaylee Berger, actually was the lawyer who deposed both the student and the teacher. We ended up fictionalizing the case somewhat, but the core of it was from a kid and a teacher she deposed. Grade inflation, we have a case on grade inflation that came from a teacher in the school that was wrestling with it, and we have a case on discipline that came from my co-author, Sigal Ben-Paraf, who was interested in also looking at sort of choices around discipline and around ethical issues in a school in her area.
You've seen it from a couple of different levels. You've been a middle school teacher. You worked in colleges and universities. Are the questions, are the ethical dilemmas any different?
That's a good question. Some of the ethical dilemmas are actually identical. So it's interesting, like the grade inflation case, where we are looking, the case itself focuses on an independent Jewish day school where the teachers feel as if they are facing undue pressure from parents and administrators to inflate grades, whereas the administrators generally feel as if, you know, the responsibility of the school is to create sort of healthy, happy kids who can contribute to improving the world and who can get into highly selective colleges, and that having some rigid grade, say, deflation policies isn't going to help that and will make it much harder in the marketplace. That's actually identical at the higher education level. In the case, we look at what happened at Princeton University, which tried for 10 years to combat grade inflation, and then they just finally gave up because it just wasn't working. And certainly at Harvard, where I teach, you know, there have been a lot of discussions, vehement discussions about grade inflation over the years. I think some of the other cases, you know, apply, say, more at K-12 than at higher education, say, questions about certain things related to school discipline. But certainly, I think that having multiple perspectives about any one ethical case is essential. I've experienced many of these cases as a teacher of teachers in my work at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, as a parent of two daughters who have gone through the Boston Public Schools and who are now actually in private schools. And so I've seen sort of different aspects and very similar aspects in a number of different school contexts. And then we have commentaries from educational researchers, from philosophers, and from legislators, teachers, school principals, district superintendents, because the idea is that none of us can figure out these questions on our own. The way we'll make better decisions is to bring together a multiplicity of perspectives, because people see different things and understand different aspects of the problem, and that's definitely come across to me in my different roles. Like, as a parent, I have seen things play out with my kids that, say, I was on the other side of when I was a teacher, and I think, oh my gosh, I now understand this issue in an entirely different way than I did when I was a, say, childless teacher. It makes a real difference to be a parent, and it makes a real difference, say, to be a researcher or to be a school leader or to be a student. And so that's part of the aim in this work, is to bring all of these different perspectives together so we can reach better decisions.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Miera Levinson continues with a look at the intersection of zero tolerance policies and ethics. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Miera Levinson, a professor of education at Harvard University. We're talking about her new book, Dilemmas of Educational Ethics, Cases and Commentaries. In the book, Dr. Levinson talks about the issues facing schools with zero-tolerance discipline policies. I asked if teachers in those schools face added ethical pressures given the consequences for students.
Yeah, so in case any of your listeners don't know about what zero tolerance is, it's a set of policies that have grown up in this country over the last 15 or 20 years, most actually, say, in response after Columbine, where it's very similar, actually, to sort of broken windows policing, where the idea is you address the little things so that ideally big things don't arise. And so if you have kids who are engaged in horseplay or who curse in class or who playfully shove somebody or speak up when they're not supposed to, they actually suffer often fairly severe consequences. They're kicked out of class, they're suspended, you know, they're given multiple days of detention or something, in hopes that then you're not going to get fights, you're not going to get weapons brought to school, et cetera. But we know that these zero tolerance policies are not developmentally responsive, right? They're not responsive to kind of kids being kids, that they are imposed disproportionately on poor kids and especially kids of color, black and brown kids, and that they really take away any sense of sort of teacher discretion. So in one way, when we've, say, shared this case of this teacher who's sort of formed a close relationship with a high school kid, Wesley, and is helping him, you know, improve his grades and do better in school, and then he seems to steal her cell phone right before Christmas break, a lot of the people we've presented the case to initially said, well, just get rid of zero tolerance, and then you've solved the problem. But of course, first of all, many of us are working in districts that have zero tolerance, so we can't just solve it by pretending that our district had a different policy. We might be able to fight against the policy, but those policies are still there. And as we then fleshed out the case, we made clear there are some people who really support it. The principal in the case is actually a black man who argues that zero tolerance is what's designed to, say, prevent more Trayvon Martins or more Michael Browns or more Eric Gardners, that the idea is you have to be really, really attentive to every move you make, especially, say, if you're an African-American boy or young man in this country. Although others certainly disagree and say, no, look, you know, somebody say, like, you know, Trayvon, he was just walking down the street. What was he doing wrong? But yeah, teachers find themselves in tremendously difficult ethical situations trying to figure out, by the district policies, they are bound to follow these zero tolerance policies. They're bound to report kids. And then they can see the cascade of consequences that may result from that. And they feel entirely torn about what to do.
You talked to so many people, got so much different input to write this book. Look ahead. Do you see these people coming together, or is ethics always going to be a moving target?
I think both, right? So we really hope people will come together and talk about the cases and read some of the commentaries and use those commentaries as ways to talk about the cases. And that's been happening already. We've had some teacher faculty groups spontaneously say, oh, this is what we want to do in our faculty meeting, and they talk about some of the cases. We've had school leaders and district leaders read the cases and discuss them with each other. And whether or not they reach full agreement, at the very least, they understand each other's perspectives better. I think they develop more nuanced approaches, and they have a starting place so that the next time that they're faced with an ethical dilemma, they're not sort of having to start from ground zero. But at the same time, ethical dilemmas, I think, will always be with us, right? You know, it is in the teachers and school leaders and parents and district leaders and so forth are in charge of vulnerable people, right? Children who are complicated and irrational and unreasonable and wonderful and hilarious and clueless. And, you know, they are always going to provide numerous ethical dilemmas as we try to help them grow into sort of fulfilling, productive human beings.
Again, the name of Dr. Miera Levinson and co-author Jacob Fay's new book is Dilemmas of Educational Ethics, Cases and Commentaries. It's published by Harvard Education Press. Okay, so let's say one day you have a little nutty and completely breach all your ethical standards. Can you just blame it on your hormones? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Are you lying to me? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Robert Josephs, professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, explains that hormones may have something to do with dishonesty.
We are often quick to judge when someone lies or commits what we believe to be an unethical act. But consider this. 93% of people reported committing one or more kinds of dishonest acts at work or school, according to Reader's Digest. Another poll by the University of Massachusetts found that 60% of people cannot go 10 minutes without lying during a conversation, telling an average of not one but three lies during that time. Why do we lie so much? What causes all of this dishonesty? One possible solution comes from the results of a series of studies I co-conducted at the Harvard Business School. In these studies, Harvard undergraduates were given the opportunity to cheat in order to make more money than they would have if they didn't cheat. Nearly half of the students cheated, but by monitoring their hormone levels, we may know why. Unlike the non-cheaters, all of the cheaters had elevated levels of testosterone and cortisol prior to cheating. Testosterone is known for creating a sense of fearlessness and invulnerability, and high cortisol levels create a highly uncomfortable psychological state that people will do almost anything to reduce. So we think that testosterone furnished the cheaters with the courage to cheat, and cortisol gave the cheaters a reason to cheat. We found that at the end of the study, those who cheated experienced a dramatic drop in cortisol levels and reported feeling relaxed and happy. So, do hormones cause people to cheat? We can't be sure. We are currently conducting experiments in which we give people drugs that change their levels of testosterone and cortisol. We hope that the results of these experiments will provide a better understanding of the role of hormones in unethical behavior.
That was Robert Josephs of the University of Texas at Austin. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. Okay, that's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.